I appreciate the selection that you made of the two subjects, two themes rather, for this meeting. In the morning we'll be studying some lessons from the book of Isaiah. And at night our lessons will be taken all together, I think, primarily at least, from the book of John, the Gospel of John. I think you're going to find that these two themes fit in together. Isaiah pointed to the coming of the Christ, the Messiah, and dealt with the hope of Israel in him. The Gospel of John deals, of course, with the Christ from the viewpoint of his deity, his godhood. So we'll try to integrate and relate the two books together as we go along. This morning I'm going to introduce the book of Isaiah. We had thought that I'd talk on the Gospel of John this morning, but inasmuch as we'll have more time for John and not so much time for Isaiah, Brother Dyer suggested yesterday afternoon that we speak at this time on Isaiah, introducing him. To me, the book of Isaiah is really the dean of all of the prophets. I think it's the greatest of them all. That in no wise minimizes the rest of them. We divide the prophets into two different groups, major and minor. Now, the major or minor has nothing to do with the quality of the prophet or prophecy or the inspiration of the prophet. We use the term major simply to designate the longer prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel. These are the longest, although the book of Hosea has more chapters than Daniel, yet is not nearly so long when you put the pages, when you compare the pages. Daniel is a much longer book than the other. Isaiah came forth at a critical time in the history of Judah. Judah and Israel. Israel was carried away into captivity during the days of Isaiah. But he came before his people. God raised him up at a very critical time. So this morning, I would like to deal briefly with the background, the historical background of the book, both from the viewpoint of the Assyrians and also of Judah itself. Now, as you read the introduction in the first verse of the book, it says, Amos, the vision that came unto Amos, of Isaiah, the son of Amos, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Right? Here were four. Here were four kings during his day: Uzziah, Jotham, and Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, Ahaz was a very wicked man. We'll deal with him in our lesson day after tomorrow. We'll talk about him and Hezekiah. Now, rather interesting to note that three of these men were good kings, one of them very wicked. Uzziah had ruled for a long period of time, some 40, 50 years there. But during that time, he raised the economic situation in Judah to one of its highest levels since the days of Solomon. And he brought great prosperity to the land. Now, this prosperity brought about corruption within the state, just as prosperity in this country in the last 30 years, has brought great corruption to this country. Now, the corruption was religious, political, social, and in these various situations there. Now, Jotham, his son, Uzziah, you remember, when he went into the temple to burn incense, was smitten with leprosy. So his son Jotham was co-regent with him for a number of years before his death. Jotham was a good king. Uzziah was a good man. One of the better kings, so also was Jotham. But Ahaz was probably as wicked as any king that Judah ever had. He had no faith in God. He called his sons to pass through the fire, as the heathen did in worship to Moloch or to other of the false gods. He went up into Syria, at Damascus, the capital of Syria, to meet with Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, and there he saw an altar. That impressed him, and he came back home and removed the altar in the temple area there, over to the north, and set up this altar after his own design. Well, of course, that was displeasing to God. Then it will point out from the 7th chapter on Tuesday morning, when we come to that chapter, when God sent Isaiah to him and told him to ask for a sign, either the height above or the depth below, and said, no, I'll not tempt Jehovah by asking a sign. Well, of course, you never tempt God when you do what God tells you to do. But he already made up his mind what he would do. He had no faith in God. He had made an alliance with Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Assyria, against the king there are a couple of kings that were in opposition to him. But at any rate, a very wicked man. Now, strange as it may be, his son Hezekiah was probably one of the best kings that Judah ever had. In fact, I think in some ways he was a better man than David. I don't mean a greater man. I don't mean a man of greater faith. But his general character seems to me to have even been better than that of David, who committed adultery and tried to cover it up with murder. So David truly was one of the great men of the Old Covenant. But Hezekiah was a wonderful man. So Isaiah prophesied during the days, or at least lived during the days of these kings. He tells us in the 6th chapter, in the year that King Uzziah died, he said, I saw Jehovah high and lifted up, and his train did fill the temple. And he saw the seraphim, all of them having 6 wings. With 2 they covered their face, with 2 they covered their feet, and with 2 they did fly. And that's when God called him under his service. And I'll read about that probably in the morning. But at any rate, God called him to the prophetic office and told him to go to the people and preach. And he asked God, how long shall I preach? And God says, until all the villages are waste and the people in captivity are either carried away and the homes are burned and all that. In other words, you just preach as long as anybody to preach to. And this was his instruction from the Lord. But at any rate, his real work as a prophet began with the death of Uzziah. But he might have done some prophesying before, at least he lived during the days of Uzziah. And apparently he had a great respect for this good king. For he seemed to think that now then the whole thing would cave in with the death of Uzziah, but it didn't, and so God called him to this work of a prophet. Now let me look from that condition, and I'll come back to it in just a moment. Let me look from that condition now over to Assyria, to the east. Right? Now there were 4 Assyrian kings during this particular time. The first one is Tiglath-Pileser. Now, we read of him in the Old Covenant. He's also called Pul in the Old Covenant. He ruled from 745 to about 727, that period of time. Now, he was a great Assyrian ruler who began to conquer the world and bring the world to what had already been begun. But he was the one that actually established the Assyrian power as the great world power of that day. Now, down here to the southwest, you have Egypt. So here is Judah, right in between Egypt and Assyria, the two great powers trying to dominate the world. And that will be an interesting aspect that I'll study from this book. But back now to Assyria. Tiglath-Pileser was a great conqueror of the world and built up the Assyrian power to one of the most cruel and oppressive peoples that I suppose had existed up until that day. The Assyrians were noted for their cruelty. They delighted in leaving the inscriptions on the monuments of their cruelty. One of the kings boasted that he had built a pyramid of the skulls of those whom he conquered. Another left a monument, or left the inscription on the monument, of his holding a bridle, and the bridle was either around the man's head or in his nose here, and he was using his spear to poke out his eyes there. And they boasted that they made the rivers run red with the blood of the slain, that they had slain. And the book of Nahum, that came a little later, about 100 years after Isaiah, it was the cry of the, it was a prophecy of the defeat and the destruction of Nineveh. It's been called the Great At Last. At last, Nineveh is destroyed. As you read the little book of Nahum, you realize that there was no one that was to grieve or was sorrowful with the destruction of Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, brought that to an end. But we're not ready for that. We'll just talk about Isaiah here. There was Tiglath-Pileser. He was followed by Sargon. Now, Sargon is mentioned only one time in the Bible, and that's in Isaiah, I believe it's the 20th chapter, that he is named. For a long time, archaeologists or scholars could find no trace of Sargon. So they decided that Isaiah was wrong on that. But within the last 100 years, 150 years, they have found a good many monuments that Sargon left, so that we recognize or know that he was one of the great kings of Assyria. Now here we read from 727, the death of Tiglath-Pileser, and of 722, a period of 5 years. Now in 722, he began the siege against Samaria, the capital of Israel. But it didn't fall during his rule. It was left the next year for Sennacherib, to destroy the city. So Shalmaneser destroyed the city. He ruled to down somewhere about 705 or something like that. This is Shalmaneser. We'll just abbreviate. I abbreviate for two reasons. It's a long word, and I don't always know how to spell those words when I start writing. So it's easier, see, just to abbreviate. But Shalmaneser was the one that completed the destruction of Samaria and carried the Israelites away into the Assyrian captivity in 721. He completed that. Now, Isaiah, I'm coming back to him in just a moment. Now, Shalmaneser was followed by Sennacherib. Now, Sennacherib was the one that invaded the land and was besieging Jerusalem, according to the 37th chapter, I believe it is, of Isaiah, when the king Hezekiah prayed earnestly to Jehovah, as you recall, and God told him not to fear them, that they'd all be dead men. And so, in the following morning, 185,000 of Sennacherib's soldiers lay dead. He was besieging Lachish, about 22 miles distant. He took the rest of his army and went on back home and didn't bother them anymore. So, then he was followed. When he got back home, he was slain by two of his sons, oh, some 20 years later. And then Esarhaddon began to rule, but we don't deal with him in the book of Isaiah. But he was followed then by Shalmaneser, who likewise is mentioned in the Bible. These men are mentioned in the prophets and in the history. But we just notice these four: Tiglath-Pileser, Sargon, Shalmaneser, and Sennacherib. Now, Isaiah prophesied during this time. Now, he prophesied between 740 and the general make it 700. I really think he prophesied beyond 700, probably to 690. But since most scholars put it at 700 here, well, we'll just accept that. And contemporary with him was Micah. Now, Micah and Isaiah prophesied in Judah. Hosea and Amos, really Amos a little about 5 years before Hosea, Amos and Hosea prophesied in Israel during this time. Now, their work was to try to turn the people back to God so that God could spare Israel from destruction. But they were unable to turn enough people back to the Lord so that God destroyed Samaria and carried away Israel into the Assyrian captivity in 721. Now, Isaiah and Micah, who prophesied in Judah, they were able to turn enough people back to the Lord with the help of a good king, Hezekiah. Now, Israel never had a good king. In all of that 200-year period, They never had a king that was faithful to Jehovah, not a one. Now, all of them worshipped after the order of Jeroboam the first, who set up the golden calf at Bethel, you remember, and the golden calf at Dan, although the one at Dan is not mentioned after that, but the one at Bethel is. But he set up the golden calf and instituted his own worship in Israel. Well, that became a snare under the people of Israel, and they never had a king in all their 200-year history that was faithful to God. But Judah did. Judah had a number of good kings. It had, Uzziah, for instance, and Jotham, and Hezekiah. And then it had Josiah, who was the last good king that they had. Of course, that was down in the days of Jeremiah, about 100 years later. Now, let's look for just a moment at the book of Isaiah. What was his task? Now, his task was to save Judah from going upon idolatry, into which he was already in idolatry, in a bad state of idolatry. But his task was to save a remnant, to take the remnant that was still faithful and establish that remnant and turn enough of the other people back to the Lord that the Lord could spare Judah. Well, Isaiah and Micah with Hezekiah were able to do that. They said a while ago, this good king made a wonderful contribution to that. Now that leads us, now you may raise the question, what is the purpose of studying the prophets? So I think there are three things that we learn from studying the prophets. First of all is the condition that exists when the prophet is speaking. Now, here is the condition, and how that condition was met. How did God meet the condition through the prophet of that day? Well, you'll find this, that the prophets, in meeting the condition of idolatry and the wickedness, immorality, they sought to turn the people back to God. They preached Jehovah as God, his holiness, his righteousness, and his judgment, and his wrath, both sides of it. Here's the righteousness of God and the holiness of God, so turn back to him and to his law and do right. On the other hand, here is the judgment of God as an expression of his wrath, the wrath of God against the ungodliness of that time. But do we learn a lesson there? I think we do. How are we to meet the condition today? Now let me look at the condition for just a moment before we look at it. Now, in this condition here, first of all, is religious apostasy. Now, sometimes we get the idea that religious apostasy is the result of the conditions in which we live. I think that's to turn it around backwards. I think the condition is the result of religious apostasy. Here was religious apostasy now. This led then to political corruption, to social corruption, here among them, and of course, moral decay. Right? Now, all of this is the result of your religious apostasy, which leads to that. Now, in our nation today, there is political corruption on every hand. You just get heart sick watching the news, the television news, reading the newspaper, this politician and that politician, the next one, and the corruption among the politicians. I don't know how the nation can last much longer, but we'll leave that with God. But then, of course, there is the social decay among us, the moral decay. The moral decay and the social corruption. Now, is religious apostasy today the result of these? I think not. These are the result of religious apostasy. Now, that religious corruption and decay goes back to the last century, when in this country, evolution, the theory of evolution, and the humanism of the philosophers of the 18th century, was in the middle of the 18th century to the last of that century, 1750 to 1800, that the humanistic philosophers became so prevalent and prominent on the continent there, and that humanism is to put all things on a humanistic basis. And thus we get away from anything that's divine or supernatural. All right? Now, with that evolution, the condition was right for Darwin's evolution. Right now, then, with your evolution and your humanism, then religion, instead of fighting that, compromised with it. The religious leaders, the religious bodies of this country, compromised with that, and so they adapted the Bible to evolution instead of fighting evolution with the Bible. And of course, then when they did that, they had nothing to preach. That led to the social gospel. So the denominations then, in the latter part of the 19th century, began to turn to the social gospel, which is to take care of the physical man, the human man, and denied the necessity of the blood atonement and the virgin birth and the resurrection, things of that nature. Right now, this then has led to the moral and social and political decay in our nation. We have nothing to hold the people when you reject God and reject His standard. Right? Now, how are we to meet that today? Exactly as the prophets met it back in their day. Meet it by preaching Jehovah God as absolute in all of His attributes and so on. Preach Jesus Christ as the Son of God, which we'll be dealing with in the Gospel of John in this meeting. To preach the Bible as the Word of God, the covenant as the covenant of God, and the blood of Jesus Christ as the saving power of God. And it's turning people back to God, back to His holiness, His righteousness, His law, His standard. And Jeremiah said, stand ye in the ways and see, and ask for the old path where is the good way, and walk therein, you shall find rest unto your souls. They said, we'll not walk therein. But whether they walk therein or not, whether they listen or not. As Isaiah said, how long, O Lord? God said, till the whole thing's gone down. Till you've either conquered or they're way in captivity and your villages are destroyed. It's not mine to ask God how long. It's not mine to say, well, people won't listen. Now, that's not mine to decide. It's my responsibility to preach the Word of God and Brother Dyes and the rest of us and you to live it. Just as long as time lasts. Now let God take care of the how long. I've been impressed with that question asked over and over in the Bible. I don't think you'll find over two or three times where God ever answered the question how long. Men ask how long. God said that's none of your business. I'll attend to that. So we'll leave the how long with God. How long is the world going to last? I don't know. Only God does. Let's leave that with Him. All right, so here's the condition then. And how did they meet it? There was political, social, and moral decay. The result of religious apostasy. Right? So that condition was met by preaching Jehovah and His holiness. Now here's another point that we won't have time to deal with, but it's dealt with by these writers, and now that's God and the nations. Now, what is God's relation to the nations? Right? Destruction. All the political nations, heathen nations, were going to be destroyed. Destruction face up. How long am I supposed to talk this morning, Brother Dyer? 10:35. Boy, I haven't seen that clock. You ought to have it back down where the folks can't see it, but we'll leave it after this meeting anyhow. And you just cover it up. All right, 10:35. Now, here then are the nations and the destruction of all these political powers. Well, Isaiah deals with that. I might stop right here now and give just a little brief summary of the book itself before we go any farther. In the first chapter, the writer points out the condition of the people as when they lift up their hands in prayer, they're covered with blood. That verse 21 and 2, Jerusalem, that had been God's dwelling place, is now a harlot. She's one of the four harlots of the Old Testament. Nineveh was the harlot of conquest and of cruelty. That's in Nahum, the third chapter, verse about 4 and 5. Then Babylon, that came later, was the mistress given to pleasures. Isaiah 37, verses about 5 through 15. Then Tyre was the harlot of commerce. Isaiah the 23rd chapter, verses 15 to 17. And Jerusalem was the religious harlot. Isaiah the first chapter, verse about 21 and 22 along there. So you have four harlots here in the Old Testament and the prophets, of which Rome in Revelation 17 and 18 is a composite harlot of the four Old Testament harlots. Rome was the heart of conquest of the world. She was also the harlot of commerce. She was given to pleasure, and she was a religious harlot who sought to persuade the people to commit spiritual harlotry or adultery, or fornication, whatever you want to call it, by worshiping the image of the emperor. So I don't think anybody can ever understand the book of Revelation who either does not study the book from one who knows the prophets, or he himself is a student of the prophets. I don't believe there's any way to understand. I think that's the key. I used to wonder why God didn't give us a key to Revelation. He did. The Old Testament is the key to it. If you understand the Old Testament and the New Testament, you're having trouble with Revelation. You'll get make it all right on that. But at any rate, you'll understand it much better. But let's pass on. Here then is Jerusalem now, is spoken of there as a harlot. How is this city given over to harlots? And so harlot. But in the morning, I want to deal with chapters 2 through 4. Jerusalem, the real and the ideal, as you look from the real to the ideal. But let's pass over that for right now. The first 12 chapters deal with the condition in Judah at that time, along with several outstanding messianic prophecies. But unless Judah repents and turns back to God, she's doomed to destruction, going into captivity. But they did turn to God and were spared. Now, beginning with chapter 13 to chapter 23, you have in those chapters God and the nations. Now, it begins, it deals with all 12 or 13, I forget how many in there, but a number of the heathen nations in which he points out the judgment of God against these nations. All right, now, what do I learn from that? I learn from that that God rules in the political nations of the world. Well, that's one of the primary teachings of the book of Daniel. One of the major lessons of Daniel is God's rule in the kingdom of men. In the fourth chapter, verse 17, as Daniel was talking to Nebuchadnezzar, and he said there that God said, until you know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever you will, even to the lowest of men. So God rules in the kingdom of men, or rather setteth up over it, and sets up over it whomsoever he will, even to the lowest of men. Well, I've been thinking for the last 25 or 30 years, or so, maybe 40, that God's been really scraping the bottom of the barrel several times when he gave us a rule in this country. I think he scraped the bottom. I think he's done better here lately this last time. I hope you have. But I was sort of disappointed in a couple of men that I thought were really great. I was strong for Nixon, I was strong for Agnew. Well, they turned out to be rascals, so I'm not putting my money on any of them until after you get through the race, and then it's too late to put your money there, so we'll just leave that. Let God take care of that. It's another one of his businesses, not mine. So I'm going to let him run that. But at any rate, these chapters deal with the kingdoms of the world. Now, what do you learn from that? You learn from that that Mr. Reagan or Mr. Carter or whoever it might be in the White House, or Mr. Khrushchev over in Russia, or Queen Elizabeth in England, or Parliament in England, or Mr. Sadat, President Sadat down in Egypt, or Begin over in Israel. These men are not running the world. Not really. God is. God's running it. God's deciding what's going to happen to it. So I don't give that much worry. They're all going to be destroyed. They're all going down in destruction. The seeds of their destruction is sown in every one of them. And did that click? All right. The seeds of our destruction is sown in every one of them. And so our nation's going to go down. I don't know just when it'll be. Whether it'll be during Reagan's administration or the next fellow's administration. It won't make any difference. You're still going down the river, going down the drain. You say, preacher, that sounds like an anarchy. Well, I'm like Patrick Henry. If that's treason, we'll make the most of it. It's still so anyhow. And so all doomed to destruction eventually. So this one's going eventually. So, but God rules in the kingdoms of men. Now, what's my job, and what am I trying to do these days in preaching? I'm trying in my preaching to build faith in the hearts of God's people that they'll be able to stand when the destruction comes. That when the fall comes, whether it's economic or an invasion or civil war within or what have you, that whenever the judgment comes, that you and I will have a faith to sustain us when that time comes. And that those about us, as Peter says there, that, beloved, I beseech you, as sojourners and pilgrims, to abstain from fleshly lust, the war against the soul. having your behavior seemly among the Gentiles. While they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works which they behold glorify God in the day of visitation. That's 1 Peter 2:11-12. So let's live in such a way with a faith that when the judgment comes, the Gentiles will look at us and see something, somebody standing solid, don't you see? Somebody then give way to it. All right. So those chapters deal with the destruction of the nations. Chapters 24 through 27, there are four chapters there that I think are extremely helpful. These four chapters deal with a world judgment. Now, here was a world judgment that was coming. Now, I don't mean the final judgment, we look at it, but a world judgment of that particular time, that particular day. Then, beginning with chapter 28, on through about 36, I think, we are dealing, or maybe 35 it is, there we're dealing now back with Judah again, and her condition at that time. Now, chapters 36 through 39 are historical chapters. Now, they deal with the invasion of Sennacherib, Sennacherib here, and of here the destruction of his 185,000, of Hezekiah's sickness, then when he was sick and recovered, and God sent Isaiah to him, you live 15 more years. As far as I know, that's the only man that ever lived, and you're exactly how long you're going to live. I'm sure glad I don't know. Aren't you? Because the closer it came, comes to me, the worse I feel. So I'm just glad I don't know. But Hezekiah knew. And then Merodach Baladan, the king of Babylon, who was in opposition to the king of Assyria, he sent an ambassage over to congratulate him on his recovery from sickness. Well, King Hezekiah, good man that he was still human. Here's another point you can learn from prophets. Every idol has its feet of clay. Drive your little pig right there. Every idol has its feet of clay. Whenever you make a man an idol, he still has his feet of clay. As great as David was, he had his feet of clay. As great as Hezekiah was, he had feet of clay. As great as some of the men had been that I have known in my lifetime that I thought were truly great preachers, they had their feet of clay. Remember, every idol had his feet of clay. Like for Hezekiah, showed that he was, that just went to his head, he kind of proud. So he showed me this ambassage, all of his wealth, everything that he had. Well, God sent Isaiah back to him. Isaiah said, who were these men? He said, why, they were from a far country. Where'd they come from? Why, they came to visit me. So, well, what'd they see? So I showed them everything I had. Then Isaiah said, although they had weathered the storm, the battle against the Assyrians, they won that one. He said, your descendants and your wealth will be carried away into Babylon. That proves that 39th chapter there. Well, for Hezekiah, I guess felt bad over what he had done, but nevertheless rejoiced that God was not going to destroy him that particular time. Now, that's the first half of the book. The second half of the book, beginning with the 40th chapter, deals with God's preparation for the captivity and the assurance of return. Now, I want to deal with that one morning because it's so important. But God begins now to prepare them for that. The 40th chapter, I deal with that one morning because it's such a great chapter, with a few verses following. The incomparable greatness of God. God promises them he'll bring them back. On what ground can they depend on that? On the ground of God's incomparable greatness. That'll be one of our, that's one of my favorite chapters in all the Bible, the 40th chapter of Isaiah. But we'll look at that one morning. I forget which morning it'll be, it doesn't matter. We'll get to it. Now, he goes on then to begin to prepare them, but now, how did he do that? He does that by showing them that he is the sole God. Now, Isaiah 40 through 48, nine chapters there. These are devoted to one major theme. There's other minor themes. One of the major themes is the incomparable greatness of God. There is no God besides Jehovah. Therefore, he's able to bring them back. Now, he rests his claim to being the sole deity on the ground of his ability to declare the future from the present, the end from the beginning. Right? Now, that's an important part in your study. God, I want to repeat that. God is willing to rest his claim to be the sole deity, the only God, on the ground of his ability to declare the end from the beginning. therefore fulfilled prophecy, becomes an exceedingly strong argument for the inspiration of the Bible. That, I think, is one of the two or three strongest. The fulfillment of prophecy, then, of course, the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, the completed revelation. Now, I'll deal with some of those from the Gospel of John, for it deals with this very matter of Christ's deity. But at any rate, so God would encourage them on this ground that he is able to fulfill his prophecies. All right. Now, in that section, chapters 40 through 66, now what's dealt with especially there? The two deliverers. These two deliverers let me leave that for just a moment. Nations are going to be destroyed. They're going into captivity among the nations to be destroyed. Even Judah as a kingdom will be brought to an end. It will be brought to an end with the captivity of Kunah. Although Jeremiah deals with that and not Isaiah. But it was brought to an end, and the northern kingdom of Israel was brought to an end when they were carried away into Assyrian captivity. So both kingdoms as kingdoms were brought to an end by Assyria and Babylon. But the people were not brought to an end. Now here's a point you want to remember there. In Jeremiah, the 30th chapter and verse 11, God says, I'll bring all the nations where I've scattered thee to a full end. But I will not bring thee to a full end, but I will nevertheless, he said, I will punish you. Now, the Jews, both north and south, as kingdoms, were brought to an end. They were never again to be established. The millennialists are just as crazy on that as they are on everything else, almost, that they're teaching. But neither of those kingdoms would ever be restored. But the people, as a people, would never be destroyed. The Jews would always exist as a people. So the Jew that walks the streets of Jerusalem, there is as much a Jew as were the Jews that walked the streets 1900 years ago and crucified Christ. The Jew that's in business here in Fresno is as much a Jew and as identifiable as a Jew in Jerusalem. Now that stands as a monument to the fact that God has spoken. I'll never bring you to a full end. They'll never be brought to a full end as a people. They are brought to a full end as a kingdom. The old kingdom that existed back yonder came to an end, never to be established again, with a king of the tribe of the house of David, with a priesthood of the priesthood of Levi. That's gone. And until that's restored, you'll never have the restoration of that which was destroyed. So remember then that here in the midst then of the destruction of these nations, on Judah and Israel would be in the group. Now, does that leave what is there then that is permanent? All right, here's what's permanent. The Messiah, the coming kingdom, and his kingdom. This is the only thing that's permanent that you're going to find. Right, so he begins, although he deals with that. In chapter 2, in chapter 7, chapter 9, chapter 11, that we'll talk about tomorrow and the next day. Yet at the same time, chapters 30 through 66 deal especially with the coming of the Messiah. There are four messianic psalms or songs. There are the Song of the Servant in the book of Isaiah. I'll deal with these one morning. Right? Then there's the coming of the Messiah who would rule in righteousness. Then he would be a kingdom that would never be destroyed. Right? So in the midst then of this condition, in the midst here of apostasy and wickedness and all of that, and the fact that the heathen nations are all going to be destroyed, even the two kingdoms of God, really one kingdom, but they were divided, that had become pagan in their worship, or heathen idolatrous in their worship, they would be destroyed. Now, here then is the Messiah, the king, and his kingdom that would rule in righteousness and never be destroyed. Right? Now, this is what you look for. When you read the prophets, you're looking for three things in particular. You're looking for the condition of the day and how was it met. Right? It was met by preaching God, his holiness and righteousness on the one hand, his judgment and wrath on the other hand. Second, and today we meet it the same way, by preaching God, his sovereign rule of God, and of his son. Right? Then second, what about the political nation, the heathen nation? They were all dead. destined to destruction. They will all be destroyed. What about the heathen nations of today? They're all going to be destroyed. Not a Christian, one Christian nation on earth. That's God's kingdom. God's not the only one. The United States is no more a Christian nation than Russia is. They're both just the political kingdoms of the world. That's all they are. There are a few Christians over here, and there may be a few over there. I don't know about that. But they don't make the nation a Christian nation. It's just a heathen political kingdom like all the rest of it. I believe our president has a little faith in God, but how much I don't know. The last one had some. I don't know how much it was. But at any rate, they're all, and the one before that, Johnson had enough faith to use him as a cuss word about every other time he spoke, but that was about the extent of his concept of God. All that Johnson had in his speeches about from the Bible were written by Horace Busby, his son, who was his writer. Horace Busby, remember, great preacher of the gospel, back in my generation. I've heard some of the greatest sermon preached by Horace Busby. Well, his son did that. After his son quit writing for him, he didn't see any more quotation in his speeches. Now, he didn't know anything about the Bible. He could have told you whether Christ was crucified or drowned trying to swim across Galilee. He didn't have any idea about that. And I don't know about the rest of them. I just go back that far. I'm not old enough to know the rest of them, so we'll stop with them. But let me go on here. In the midst of the destruction, on what can I depend? What could they look for? We're going into captivity. God says you're going into Babylonian captivity. All right, now, what can we look for beyond that? We look for two things. There are two rulers now that God's going to raise up. It will be Cyrus, whom he will raise up here to allow them to come back. And I want to talk a little bit about Cyrus when it comes to him. I'm kind of an admirer of Cyrus. The 44th and 5th chapter, God named him. God even went so far as to name him 100 years before he was born. Who it was that would deliver his people, be a man of them, a Cyrus, my shepherd, whom I have anointed. That's the only heathen king in the whole Bible that God ever said, I anointed him. God anointed him, Mr. Erickson. But all that you know about Cyrus from history, I read the other day, can be written on 6 pages. You could take 6 pages and write everything in the world we know about Cyrus, so we don't know much about him. But what we do know is good. It's all good. He allowed him to come back. So here was Cyrus, the great political deliverer that would allow them to come back from captivity. Now, over against him, here is the servant. Now, you call the servant, God's servant, here, and that's the Messiah, and he will be the Redeemer spiritually, the spiritual Redeemer. So here are two great deliverers dealt with in Isaiah. Cyrus, the king of the Persians, who conquered the Medes and combined the two powers and overthrew Babylon, and issued the decree that they could all return to their homeland. Right, now, Daniel deals with that, of course, with this, when he talks about Darius the Mede. Well, Darius the Mede was in history a man by the name of Gubairu. The governor of Persia, it is thought, or Elam, rather. It might have been Elam, but evidently he was a Mede. But the Medes and the Persians were closely related in their ancestry. But be that as it may, he was the one that ruled over Babylon, but Cyrus was the conqueror, and appointed Gubairu, or Darius the Mede, to rule there. At any rate, he issued the decree that they could return home, so they returned home in 537 from their captivity, and they were to rebuild the temple, but didn't get at it, so God raised up Haggai and Zechariah to urge them to complete the temple. They completed it in 536 they came back. And they completed the temple in 516. Now, all of these prophets, to me, are fascinating. I love to study the prophets. I love to teach the prophets. Because they're just as alive in 1981 as they were whenever they wrote and spoke. They're meeting issues of that day parallel to the issues that we're meeting today. And so Isaiah, then, in the time of the threat of a great power, such as today we are threatened by the great power of Russia or the great internal destruction of ourselves, we are threatened with some kind of a judgment and we know it. Isaiah is at home today preaching to us of the fact that conditions can be met only by turning the people's hearts back to God. As I said when Reagan was elected and everybody was rejoicing over it, that won't change anything. The only way you can change things is to change the hearts of people. Now, until we change the hearts of people, there's going to be no change. We'll still be faced with the same problems. He may be able to prolong it a little while, but the problem will still be there. We're beyond the point of no return. Right now, in the midst of that, let's point people to God. the nation itself is ultimately going to be judged and go down. What can I depend on? I can depend on Hebrews 12 and verse 28, therefore receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. I can depend on that kingdom. I can depend on Jesus Christ as my King, who never lost a skirmish or a battle. I can depend on the new covenant as the Constitution that no Supreme Court can ever tear to pieces and cast down and stamp underfoot as it has ours. I've got something I can stand on. So here then, in the midst of all of this corruption, in the midst of the threat of destruction, what is there that is permanent? The King, Jesus Christ, and the kingdom that God established on the firm foundation that will never be shaken. That's our introduction. We'll start back there in the morning with chapter 2, and after a while we'll introduce the Gospel of John. All right. Pastor, excuse me, brother. I guess you're ready for it to go. I'm trying this off.